positivity. That does it for our show. A happy pre-birthday to Mike Burke. I'm Amy Goodman for another edition of Democracy Now!
You wake up to the 8 o'clock buzz to get the week started.
Now, we need the help of a good volunteer to run our on-air operations each Monday.
Sure, that means waking up a little earlier.
To get to the station around 7:30.
But that's why WORT has coffee.
So that you can start your week off right.
WORT is recruiting a volunteer to run the soundboard each week on Monday mornings from 7:30 to 9 a.m.
You'd run all on-air operations for our morning program, The 8 O'Clock Buzz with Brian Standing.
No experience is necessary, but a familiarity with computers and a strong sense of punctuality and reliability are preferred.
For details, call 608-256-2001 and ask to speak with Shali Pittman.
Or head online to WORTFM.org/volunteer to fill out our volunteer application.
Welcome to Madison Labor Radio. Labor Radio is dedicated to bringing news, information, and cultural events focused on working people and the labor movement to the Madison area and surrounding communities. I am David Delier. Your support is necessary to make Labor Radio and all the great programming on WORT possible.
Hi, I'm Ann Habel, a retired member of AFSCME 171, UW Blue Collar Workers. Today, we cover school referenda and school board elections on the April 2nd ballot, efforts to rebuild the union in the public sector, the UE contract at Willie Street Co-op, the impact of AI on our workplace, and much more.
In addition to candidates, the spring election will have four school referenda on the ballot. Carol Weidel has the story.
Today, the Wisconsin legislature limits public school spending on the costs of education. These basic school costs include staff, operations, and maintenance. Both state aid and local property taxes provide these needed school funds. From 1994 to 2009, this limit has been adjusted upward for inflation. As a result, school districts were able to keep up with the growing needs. However, since 2010, these resources have fallen farther behind. By 2025, the revenue limit will have fallen $3,500 per student behind due to inflation. Because these limits do not meet the needs of the school districts, local communities must fill the funding gaps. More than 80% of school districts have asked voters to support increased funding with a referendum. Some of these school districts needed to use a referendum more than once. On Tuesday's ballot, there will be school referendum for four school districts in Dane County: Marshall, McFarland, Stoughton, and Wisconsin Heights. The Joint School District of Marshall is a capital referendum for facility improvements. The McFarland, Stoughton, and Wisconsin Heights referenda seek revenue for maintaining instructional and operational costs. Sources for this story are the League of Women Voters of Dane County and the Wisconsin Association of School Business Officials. Reporting for Labor Radio, this is Carol Weidel.
The April 2nd election includes many school board seats across Wisconsin. Traditionally nonpartisan contests, school board seats have become more contentious and politically polarized. Labor Radio spoke with Christina Bry, the public affairs manager for the Wisconsin Education Association Council, or WEAC.
Why have some school board races in Wisconsin become so polarized?
When it comes to local school board elections, we have seen almost a training ground created on some very far right networks. What we've seen is great investments in Wisconsin over the past, I'd say, about 10 years, in which national money has come in to provide these types of training and recruitment efforts to almost take over local school boards in some communities. Residents are used to local folks who care about public schools, but these outside groups, some of the best known Moms for Liberty, which we saw end up in some pretty hot water nationally, making some inroads in local school boards. What we found, though, is that local communities aren't having much of that. We've seen over the past 2 years, the mask kind of pulled off of these efforts to overtake local school districts through school board elections. We've seen more Moms for Liberty and similar type candidates losing as voters say, no, we want to elect people to serve on our local school boards who actually are invested in the community and have the same values as we have.
Can you talk about the relationship between labor and public education?
Labor has always supported public education because making sure that the right of students to learn, no matter what their family background, their income, any factor, our kids all deserve a chance to learn and to have an even playing field. When we see folks who are putting their hat in the ring for a school board race, but sowing hatred and misinformation and disinformation, it tells me that there are people out there who want to upset that idea, that value of creating that even playing field for kids, something that labor and our teachers union, our educators union, believes deeply in the power of public education to shape lives. We will stand against anybody who wants to dismantle the public schools that have made our state what it is. That's why we recommend candidates after we screen them and talk with them. That's why we work so hard against all odds to elect state officials, federal officials, local officials who care as deeply as we do about students.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Vote, vote, vote. If you don't know if there's something on your ballot, if there's a school board race, you can go to myvote.wi.gov. and see what's on your ballot. If there is a school board race on your ballot, I would encourage you to talk to a local teacher, talk to a local education support professional to find out what they're thinking about and what your local public schools most desperately need when it comes to leadership.
That was Christina Bry. This is Janine Ramsey reporting for Madison Labor Radio.
The spring election on Tuesday, April 2nd, will include two proposed constitutional amendments on the backside of the ballot. The AFL-CIO of Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Education Association Council, or WEAC, are recommending a no vote on both amendments. Other groups urging a no vote on the amendments include the League of Women Voters of Wisconsin, Wisconsin Conservation Voters, and the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. Republican legislators and conservation groups, such as the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, are advocating for the amendments. If these amendments pass this vote, they will become law. Voters can read what is on their ballot by going to myvote.wi.gov.
State workers in Wisconsin face big challenges as they try to rebuild their unions since Act 10. Barbara Smith, a member of the Wisconsin Public Employees Council, AFT 4848, at the Wisconsin Department of Administration leads a cross-departmental coalition of state workers to begin that process. Brian Novinsky-Lois has the story.
Hello, Barbara. Thanks for meeting with me tonight. Could you describe the State Worker Power Group and how it fits into the larger context of public sector unions in Wisconsin?
We are a group of state employee union activists and union-friendly co-workers. And we have a few retirees and also a couple allies. So we felt that we needed to include people from various unions to meet together because we have so much in common. We started meeting before the pandemic, but we did switch to Zoom meetings, but we have tried to take actions in real life.
What challenges have there been in maintaining communication and support since Act 10?
There's about 30,000 classified staff who work in state agencies, not including the UW. So we are the traditionally unionized frontline workforce, non-supervisory. So that's a lot of people. It's statewide, and some of our locals used to be statewide. So there's a lot of barriers to connecting everybody up again. So we just decided to start with a few people that we know and kind of see if we can organically branch out.
Can you highlight any successes or victories?
One of the things we tried to do is get meet and confer back. And we did get that back. But that has been an advance in the communication between unions and basically human resources, the personnel department. We did get a commitment that they would let us send a survey to state workers. And we did that. It did take them well over a year to make good on that promise, but we did make it happen. We got a number of people to answer a little survey and tell us a little bit about their interest in the union. And we have been following up on that and contacting those people. We know that there's a lot more interest out there. So it's a matter of us going back. But this gave us enough to start working with.
In what ways do you believe public sector unions in Wisconsin still serve a vital role to workers?
Well, I think public sector unions are vital to everyone because the need for quality public services is just so crucial. You know, it's what everybody in Wisconsin deserves. And that's the business that we're in, is delivering those public services, high quality ones. Unions are a part of that because you can't have good public services without a positive working environment for the people delivering those services.
And why should public sector employees become more involved in their unions and the State Worker Power Group?
People are forgetting how things used to be and some of our major rights people don't know about because they haven't had a chance to learn about them. We want people to get involved because every day public employees are going to work. And if we join together, we can make our working lives better. You know, we need to talk about our problems, our wins, and how the status in our agencies so we can move ahead together.
Well, that's all the questions I have for you tonight. Thanks again for meeting with me. That was Barbara Smith, a member of WEPAC AFT 4848. This is Bryant Novinsky-Lois for Madison Labor Radio.
Next, the president of the union representing workers at Willie Street Co-op talks about their new contract and more.
Since their election victory in 2019, workers at Madison's Willie Street Co-op grocery stores have been members of the United Electrical Radio and Machine Workers of America, the UE, Local 1186. And this week, they ratified a new 3-year contract with Willie Street Management. Labor Radio spoke on Wednesday to Local 1186 president Mike Tomaloff.
Yeah, we had we ratified the contract through a vote with the workers last Monday, and we had wrapped up our bargaining the week prior on a Wednesday. And that took, I think we had 3 weeks of bargaining sessions, Tuesday, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at the central office at the co-op. And this is our first time since our first contract in 2020 that we got to bargain face-to-face. We didn't have to go online and do it like we did during the pandemic. So it was easier to come to agreement on a lot of things. And sure, there were things that we proposed that they rejected, and certainly there were things they proposed that we rejected. But all in all, it was fairly collegial. And the last week when we got into financial stuff, that's always going to be the rough stuff. But even then, it wasn't too terrible.
Tomaloff described some features of the new contract.
People who have been there for more than a year can take up to 40 hours of unpaid time for full-time workers. We also have a a new program for folks who don't qualify for FMLA and may face a medical emergency. It's a 90-day medical leave from the co-op. It's unpaid, but it gets you through if you can't get FMLA, because FMLA requires a year of service and so many hours of time. We got across-the-board raises for all our coworkers. It's a 3-year contract, so we'll get a raise every year in March. And I think most importantly, there were a lot of staff at the co-op who've been there for, you know, 10, 15, sometimes 20 or 25 years. They didn't get the promotions. They didn't get the financial reward that other people got in that time. There's folks that have been there for 20 years that make, you know, pennies over the top wage for their band. And we got those folks some relief. Now, after 5, 7, 10, 15, and 20 years, there's various pay bumps. That covered all the folks who were neglected in the past, back when the co-op only gave 3% raises and not everybody got one.
The Willie Street Co-op is structured under what it calls an owner-member model. Tom Loff talked about the continuing supportive role between the union and its owner members.
Member owners of the co-op, they're kind of our ace in the hole sometimes. If we were really in trouble, we know that they'll support us and they'll send in customer comment cards and they'll flood the phones with critiques and suggestions for management. They've done that in the past, that's for sure. We were ready to engage them if we needed to, but we were doing pretty good on our own. And what I would say to co-op member owners is, when you see someone with that union pin, thank them for being in the union. I'm grateful for everybody who signs up and joins our cause and supports the union. You know, be cognizant of those folks who are in the union and encourage them for their good work.
Tomaloff has a message for workers in unorganized groceries and other jobs in the Madison area.
Anyone out there who's listening that's in the grocery industry or, you know, has a job where you just don't feel heard or you're neglected and you're not paid well and no one wants to hear what you think or to get fired over no reason at all, hey, reach out. We'd love to organize some more shops in Madison. There's a lot of good work to do in the union, and I think there's a lot of grocery stores that could use some UE power. And I encourage folks to reach out at ueunion.org and get in touch.
That was Mike Tomaloff, president of UE Local 1186, representing workers at Willie Street Co-op. Local 1186 members ratified a new 3-year contract on Monday. For Labor Radio, I'm Greg Jaboski.
The Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled that some Amazon drivers are employees, not independent contractors.
On Monday, the Wisconsin Supreme Court let stand a lower court ruling that some drivers for Amazon were employees. The decision was unanimous. Specifically, the ruling found that drivers employed by Amazon Flex are part of the state's unemployment insurance program and entitled to jobless pay if laid off. The decision means that an Amazon subsidiary may get a tax bill of more than $200,000. Gig workers, unions, and worker advocates have been fighting for years, claiming that most gig workers are misclassified as independent contractors and thus denied various rights as employees, not to mention benefits and subject to irregular wages. Each state has its own laws regarding the independent contractors, so it is unclear what the impact of this particular ruling will be. However, it is one more win for gig workers in lawsuits initiated by workers and their supporters around the country. Here in Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development conducted an audit of 1,000 drivers at Amazon Logistics between 2016 and 2018 and concluded the vast majority of drivers were employees. Meanwhile, the U.S. Department of Labor enacted a new rule on March 11th that aims to prevent the misclassification of workers as independent contractors. If implemented, the new rule would support legal protections and bolster income as it applies to wages and overtime, but not unemployment compensation. Information for this report comes from the Wisconsin State Journal, Wednesday, March 27th. I am Frank Emspach for Madison Labor Radio.
A committee of mayors and ex-mayors who support President Biden's electoral campaign were in town, Labor Radio reports.
On Tuesday, the Madison Labor Temple on South Park Street was jumping with a visit by what Labor Radio was told was a private affair featuring the Joe Biden election co-chair Mitch Landrieu, the former mayor of New Orleans and former lieutenant governor of Louisiana, who is now the co-chair of Biden's re-election committee. Among the politicians and workers entering the Labor Temple was Madison Mayor Satya Rose Conway, who is a board member of the Democratic Mayor's Committee, which is working to re-elect President Biden.
Mitch Landrieu, who is one of the co-chairs of President Biden's campaign, is here in Wisconsin. He's been in Milwaukee, in Racine. He's now in Madison. He's headed to La Crosse and Wausau. And he is going around the state meeting with mayors and learning about the investments that we have made thanks to the funding that the Biden administration has provided.
Rhodes Conway considers President Biden a strong friend of labor.
I think President Biden has been the most labor-friendly president, certainly in my lifetime. I've never seen a president walk a picket line before. He has been pretty consistent in all of the funding that he's put forward in trying to make sure that it does go to folks in organized labor.
The mayor was asked about the Madison budget shortfall, which threatens the jobs of city workers.
Well, council hasn't decided what direction they want to go with the budget yet, but one of the things that we are looking at is a structural deficit, which is entirely designed by Scott Walker and his cronies and passed as part of that budget bomb that he dropped in Act 10. And one of the things that Scott Walker did was to make sure that cities could not have the resources that we need. That's hit Madison, and we are going to have to deal with it as a community now. One of my top priorities and one of the things that I have heard from the council is that they do not want to lay anybody off.
As our interview with the mayor wrapped up, Harry Richardson, secretary of AFSCME Local 171, the union representing the technical and blue-collar workers at UW-Madison, came up to hand the mayor a leaflet calling for workers to vote uninstructed rather than for Joe Biden in Tuesday's Democratic Party primary election as a protest to the Biden administration's continued support of Israel during that country's ongoing attacks on Palestinians in the Israeli-occupied Gaza Strip. He also talked to Biden campaign co-chair Mitch Landrieu just as Landrieu was about to step through the door to the event. Richardson had supported recommendations to the AFL-CIO from both his local and the South Central Federation of Labor, or SCUFL, asking the national AFL-CIO to call for a ceasefire in Gaza. According to Richardson, Landrieu told him that Joe Biden did support a ceasefire in Gaza. Richardson was not buying it.
All Biden has to do is make a phone call to Netanyahu saying there'll be no more military aid, and that campaign in Gaza would screech to a halt. That's the only thing keeping it going is the U.S. government. How can Biden say that he's for a ceasefire when his own representative at the UN does not vote for a ceasefire?
There was Harry Richardson of AFSCME Local 171 speaking Tuesday outside a Joe Biden campaign event at Madison's Labor Temple, attended by, among others, Biden campaign co-chair Mitch Landrieu and Madison Mayor Satya Rhodes Conway. For Labor Radio, I'm Greg Jaboski.
Another violator of child labor laws was caught and punished at a manufacturer of components for heavy equipment. Carol Weidel has the story.
The U.S. Department of Labor will require a Morristown, Tennessee manufacturer to turn over profits from the use of oppressive child labor to compensate victims. A federal consent decree requires that this manufacturer of outdoor power equipment for companies like John Deere, Toro, and Yamaha stop employing children illegally and to follow child labor laws in the future. This judgment, which comes after the Wage and Hour Division identified several children employed in dangerous jobs, includes a civil money penalty of more than $296,000. The employer must also set aside $1.5 million to surrender 30 days of profits related to the use of child labor. The action addressed Tough Torque Corporation's illegal employment of children. To date, the department has determined that Tough Torque subjected 10 children to oppressive child labor. Investigators began its probe months ago but obtained clear evidence of the unlawful conduct on January 23rd when they returned to Tough Torque's facility and observed a child operating a power-driven hoisting apparatus, an occupation prohibited for children under the age of 18. As a result, the department objected to the shipment of goods from the Morristown facility, citing the Fair Labor Standards Act's hot goods provision, which prevents employers from shipping goods produced by oppressive child labor. Wage and Hour Division Jessica Lumen commented on this case. Even one child working in a dangerous environment is too many. Over the past year, we have seen an alarming increase in child labor violations, and these violations put children in harm's way. With this agreement, we are ensuring Tough Torque takes immediate and significant steps to stop the illegal employment of children. When employers fail to meet their obligations, we will act swiftly to hold them accountable and protect children. Tough Torque has agreed, among other provisions, to do the following. Contract with a community-based organization to provide regular training to staff, managers, and contractors. Establish anonymous tip line for reporting child labor and other suspected Fair Labor Standards Act violations. allow unannounced and warrantless searches of its facilities for 3 years. And finally, to refrain from entering any new contracts with staffing agencies or other contractors with child labor violations, and will require contractors to disclose child labor violations and hiring protocols. In fiscal year 2023, the department investigated 955 cases with child labor violations involving 5,792 children nationwide, including 502 children employed in violations of hazardous occupation standards. The department addressed these violations by assessing employers with more than $8 million in civil money penalties. Reporting for Labor Radio, this is Carol Weidel.
To find out about the impact that generative artificial intelligence may have on workers, Labor Radio talked to Emma Goldberg, a New York Times reporter who covers the future of work and the culture of the workplace, and who has written on this topic.
How would you define generative artificial intelligence?
Artificial intelligence technology that's capable of generating text, images, sound, so it's capable of creating the type of creative content that I think we've typically thought only humans were capable of producing.
What might be some examples?
ChatGPT, which is a chatbot that you can give a prompt to, and it'll generate a response for you. So you can say, write me a sonnet in the style of Shakespeare, and ChatGPT can just make something up.
What are some key takeaways that you have uncovered about the impacts of generative artificial intelligence on work and workers?
Generative artificial intelligence has the capacity to affect the way many, many people do their jobs. And in fact, it already has started to change how some people do their jobs, because there is some work that we've traditionally thought only human workers were capable of doing. And now more and more, it's looking like this technology is going to be able to do that work as well, whether it's writing memos, writing performance reviews, writing advertising copy. So there are a lot of questions raised about what will people do once the technology can do their jobs for them, potentially even quicker than a human can.
Are there certain types of work that you believe will see a greater impact?
There's been a lot of research about what are the occupations that are going to be most vulnerable to the effects of AI. And there are long lists that have been made, but everyone from paralegals, medical transcriptionists, copywriters, anyone whose work is involved in the production of text that generative AI can now do. There is quite a broad spectrum of people whose jobs will most likely be affected in some ways by generative AI.
What do you think workers could do to prepare themselves for what lies ahead?
One thing that workers can do is learn how to use generative AI to make themselves better and more efficient at their jobs, rather than thinking of generative AI as something that will replace them.
Are there concerns about generative AI in terms of its negative effects?
There are concerns about the inaccuracies that can spread through generative AI. There's a possibility that misinformation can be spread. It doesn't have that human brain that's able to do the extra layer of fact checking. And there's issues where it does something called hallucinating, meaning making up information entirely. There's still a lot of processes that are too high stakes, whether it's law or medicine, to be given over to generative AI entirely. And we still really need a human brain that's capable of exercising judgment and discernment.
Is there a way for working people to have a seat at the table in decision-making about generative AI in their fields and workplaces?
Absolutely. And unions are playing a really important role here in working with employers to make sure people are protected as generative AI is rolled out. And that means making sure that workers are trained on how to use the generative AI. Unions are really lobbying to make sure that workers get access to job retraining and to make sure that even if generative AI is incorporated into the workplace, that that doesn't mean that jobs are going to be eliminated, but instead that new jobs will be created and that working people are prepared and empowered to use generative AI on the job and not be replaced by it.
What can we do to keep ourselves informed and involved?
So I would just say get involved in your union and be reading constantly are ways that I've seen working people engage with this issue really constructively.
That was Emma Goldberg. This is Janine Ramsey reporting for Madison Labor Radio.
Final number this evening. We'd like to play a piece written by my brother.
Thanks for listening to Madison Labor Radio. I'm David Delier. Thanks to editor Frank Emspeck, assistant Robin G., copy editor Simon Gordon, reporters Greg Jaboski, Carol Weidel, Janine Ramsey, Bryant Novinskalois, and damage control specialist Joanne Powers. Special thanks to Keith Steffen, our reader coordinator, engagement editor Alice Herman, and to all of our readers and the members of IBEW Local 2304 WORT Staff Collective.
And I'm Ann Habel. We'd also like to thank all of the generous contributors to Labor Radio and WORT. Please stay tuned for the Blues Cruise with Dave Watts and the Professor Bill Clark.
You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Hi, I'm Mel from the Mel and Floyd Show. Come on down and join Floyd and me Friday, April 5th from 1 to 2 for our annual Wisconsin Film Festival live show. This year we'll be broadcasting from the Bartell Theater, 116 East Mifflin Street. We'll be interviewing our usual assortment of interesting people from the fest, including directors, actors, writers, people from the craft services table, and if we have some time to fill, maybe some interesting looking passersby. We'll cover raging film controversies such as popcorn, butter or no butter, seating, center or aisle, and how to properly shush a loud patron. Heady stuff? It certainly is. Yes, it's going to be quite the wild ride indeed. So let's all go to the lobby. Come join the fun with Mel and Floyd at the Bartell Theater Friday, April 5th from 1 to 2 for our annual Wisconsin Film Festival remote broadcast.